25th of August. It looks like we're about 10 minutes after the hour of 9 a.m. We have with us this morning Representative Guttenberg, Representative Stoltz, Representative Samuels, Representative Kelly, Senator Wagner, Senator Terrio, myself, Senator Seekins. Around the table, we have Mr. Van Tile, Mr. Dickinson, Mr. Menge, Mr. Griffin, Mr. Finitza, Mr. Marks, Mr. Porter, Mr. Walker, Mr. Shipkoff, Mr. Whitaker. We have a full house. Welcome back this morning, gentlemen. We're going to pick up where we left off yesterday.
Mr. Chair, this is Kim Elton. I'm on in Juneau.
Okay. We're going to Kim Elton is with us. Anybody else online this morning?
Yes. Senator Seekins, this is Ed Toomey from Morrison & Foerster. I'm on from Washington, D.C. I was called and asked to get on the phone.
Okay, Mr. Toomey, appreciate that.
Good to hear you again.
And you're one of those FERC attorneys, aren't you, or something like that?
Your memory is very good, yes.
A small group. I never call it incestuous, just closely related.
And we're all old.
Okay. Where did we leave off, gentlemen? We were talking about Mr. Marks. You had the floor, if I remember.
I think I completed my last thought.
Okay.
I don't know if there are new issues we want to get into. I'd be happy to bring up new ones.
The issues that we had talked about were the to and through Canada issues, and
I think one issue, Mr. Chairman, is we left unresolved.
Use that microphone a little closer, if you can, Mr. Marks.
We brought the issue about how FERC would treat the issue of unused space in terms of cost recovery, and we have Mr. Toomey on the line to address that issue if we want to get into that now.
Mr. Toomey, are you familiar with the issue that we're talking about, or should we thumbnail that for you?
No, Senator. As you recall, I was up there 2 weeks ago or so in Juneau when the Y line concept was discussed, so I'm familiar with it.
And the question that we were talking about is the construction of a larger line to Delta, with the thought that somewhere down the line it would connect to the lower 48, but in the meantime it would provide the 1.2 BCF a day to the liquefaction plant down there, and whether or not FERC would allow the construction cost to be rolled into the tariff. Is that correct?
Well, the cost over and above what was actually needed to move the gas that was actually being transported through the pipe.
Correct. Okay, Mr. Toomey, you've got a grasp of that, I'm sure. Could you maybe help us on that issue?
Sure.
From your perspective?
20 years ago, I've been before FERC for almost 30 years now. 20 years ago, I would have answered that question by saying FERC most likely would have told the applicant not to build the line at that size. They would have refused to grant the application or said come back in 3 years when the line will be full. Today, I'd answer that a little differently. FERC is less insistent that an applicant for a certificate be able to show that the pipeline is going to be 90 to 100% full. But the quid pro quo of that is if an applicant comes in and says, I want to build a pipeline twice the size of what I have FT commitments for, FERC, as I say, more likely today than 20 years ago would say, okay, we'll let you build that line at that size, but you, the applicant, are going to bear the cost of the excess capacity. And that can be done in two ways. One is if a 12-inch line instead of a 48-inch line would have been the proper sizing for the 1.3 BCF, you could get some experts in and have them give some testimony as to what the different cost of a 48-inch line versus a 12-inch line was, and back that cost out of the rate base. Alternatively, and probably this is the way the FERC would do it, is they'll say, we'll look at this line as if it's going to be full and figure the cost that way. And let me give you a hypothetical example. Suppose the total cost of service is calculated to be, and I'll use a small here to make it simple, it'd be $100. And that means that you add up all the costs of the pipeline, and that is the operating costs, the income taxes necessary, the return on rate base, i.e. the profit margin. Add all that up, and let's say the company needs to get $100 to make itself whole, including getting its reasonable profit return. And let's say there would have, it would have taken 50 units to make that pipeline full. FERC would calculate a tariff by saying that there's a $100 cost of service. There are 50 units that are going to be going through the pipeline. Therefore, each unit will bear $2 a cost per unit. And now we got the fact situation that the Port Authority is presenting us, where for the first 3 years at least, there's going to be roughly a quarter of the pipe only full, and let's 12, you know, instead of 50 units, there's 12 coming through. Now, what FERC will say is, under their policy, as I would guess they would come out in a order with this fact situation, they would say, no, we're going to still allow you to charge only $2 per unit. And we're not going to increase the per unit cost because there's only 12 or 13 units going through. So what that means is that those 12 units, originally, if the pipe was full, there should have been 50 units, and therefore 50 times 2 is 100. Now if there are only 12 or 13 units, the pipeline is only going to collect 2 times 12 or 13, or roughly $25, which means there's $75 that pipeline is going to have to, the investors in that pipeline are going to have to eat for this 3-year period. That is, that's a little bit long-winded, but that is my estimate of what FERC would do were presented with this hypothetical situation today.
Questions for Mr. Toomey? Mr. Van Tuff.
Just a comment. I also contacted our FERC attorneys about the same issue, and they had a very similar response to what Mr. Toomey just described. The spare capacity would not be allowed to be rolled into the rate base, but instead would be the responsibility of the applicant or ultimately the investors.
Other questions? And Mr. Walker.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for clarification, you know, we looked at this scenario because we felt that was best for Alaska. It's not integral to, we don't have to have a larger pipe for this or a project to be economic. It becomes more economic if you have a smaller pipe. But we looked at this because we looked at the vast amount of resources on the North Slope and felt that would be in the best interest of the future of Alaska to be able to have that option. We checked with our FERC counsel, who was the former deputy general counsel for FERC, and felt that that was a possibility. If it's not, it's not. I mean, it's not that our project is driven or dependent upon a larger pipe. It clearly is not. It's to our somewhat to our disadvantage that we do that. We do that because we think of the best interest of Alaska. When we get down to the actual size of the pipe, if that's not going to happen, it's not going to happen. That's fine. I mean, Enbridge, we've all heard the presentation by Enbridge of 236-inch pipes. Is their scenario? Maybe that's what happened. So, I mean, this is interesting. We appreciate the input. I think it's valuable. I don't really have a point, counterpoint response. I just want you to understand that the motivation is not that we have to have an oversized pipe or we can't do the project. We just think it's better for Alaska.
And that's my question is, can you do that and recover it and make it economic for you? I guess that was my question. Go ahead, Mr. Shipkoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was on the call with our FERC counsel, and he actually not only said that he thought that that's what we're suggesting is possible, his words were that he thinks that that's the only thing that the FERC is reasonably reasonable to expect that they're going to allow, because we're not, again, talking about oversizing the pipeline gratuitously. The pipeline is properly sized for the proper commercial development of the field. We're not going to be building a pipeline in isolation from what the shippers, what's in the shippers' interest. It's going to be a negotiated rate, and it's going to be the type of arrangement that makes best commercial sense for all parties. I do not see how the argument can be made that FERC is going to step in and overrule a commercial agreement that makes sense for all parties.
Well, what you know, let me ask you the question. What is that commercial agreement? I mean, when you talk about that? Is that a commercial agreement with the producers up there for a future expansion? Is that what you're anticipating, or is it in hopes of a future expansion without that agreement?
I don't think we're suggesting that we will be sizing the pipe to accommodate future expansion if we did not expect a future expansion. That means that for us to be engineering, to be engaging engineers to design a pipeline that accommodates future expansion, that means that we must have had discussions with the shippers, whoever that may be, such that we anticipate there will be an expansion. We're not going to, we don't have to oversize. Again, it's not oversizing it, it's sizing it to accommodate a future expansion. Why would we do that if we didn't know that an expansion was coming or there was not a reasonable expectation?
My question, exactly. That is exactly my question.
Well, if the scenario then is that there is a reasonable expectation that the expansion will not happen, what does that scenario mean? That means that the highway project is not proceeding.
What I'm looking at, I guess, is my purpose is to try to look at this through the eyes of my constituency and take a look at what is in the best interest of those folks. So that's my entire purpose of looking at it. So when I look at it, I say, okay, if we're going to, this commercial agreement, do you anticipate that talks will, have we had talks on a commercial agreement like that, or do we anticipate that you guys would be talking with the producers? Because there are only four shippers that I can figure out, and that's, the three producers in the state of Alaska.
There are four shippers today. We're not
right.
Sure who potential shippers might be at some point in the near or more distant future. But
we do know that Anadarko is planning on an exploration effort in sometime in the future, and some of the others are too. But four that we could look at now, Shell and a few others. But four that we know right now. So where are we in conversations with them?
Well, we would like to engage in conversations about commercial gas supply. We clearly are not going to have a project without such a discussion.
Okay. Mr. Walker? Mr. Mayor? Go right ahead. Mr. Whitaker?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Shipkoff is dead on. There's no conversation if there's no gas. And again, that takes us back to the fulcrum point. It seems to me that the legislature, given its legal mandate, its legal responsibility, and the administration, would fully understand that if there is incremental value relative to a Port Authority or other projects similar, that then you would exercise the responsibility to enforce laws and enforce leases and ensure that gas supply be made available. That's the essence of our conversation. If the legislature and the administration is unwilling to do that, then indeed that which is in the best interest of the three major producers is that which will proceed. And that runs the gamut of doing nothing for another 30 years or doing something that strips significant value relative to the state's share from a deal. And we're here to say we think that's unacceptable. You do have another option, and that you have the responsibility to ensure that that option be given fair value. We think that's part of this process that we're in, and that's why we're at the table. And we appreciate very much, Senator, the opportunity to be at this table. We do feel that we're treated very fairly, and we appreciate that very much.
Thank you. Ms. Porter.
I do appreciate the state's responsibility. As I think that the Port Authority mentioned yesterday, the only way that we can end up with a success scenario with the Port Authority is to cut a commercial deal with the producers. If you look at what I'm going to call a failure leg, which is that the project is not moving forward, and the only way to move it forward is to get back the gas, I think you're looking at an extended period of time frame, which is not a situation where you're looking at trying to capture this incremental value in the three-year differential. You will not capture that. And at that point, all you're trying to do is to save a project at all. And that hopefully is not a route with it. I think that's not a success scenario, and that's not one that we should any of the statements you propose. We've got to recognize it, realize that that's the failure to take responsibility, and be prepared to go that direction if nothing else happens. But I think that that's, you try to cut your commercial deal first.
Well, we have Mr. Toomey online, I realize, again, there are at least three parties here that have FERC, four, because the state also has a FERC attorney that works, three anyhow, right now. FERC is one of those things that I'm not very, very familiar with, but I've gotten more familiar with over the last several months. The process, we heard, let's just step through that process. The process that we heard is that somewhere in this time frame for both projects, or at least for the Port Authority project, there's going to have to be a determination made as to whether or not this project is going to be regulated by FERC or will be exempt from regulation by FERC. Where does that happen? How does it happen? What is the timing for it? Mr. Toomey first, then maybe Mr. Walker.
The Senator, it would not be, let's say the Port Authority were to take and keep the position that they are exempt from regulation, it would not, under that scenario, it would not be clear when FERC would step in and try and assert it. It would be obviously sometime before the first shovelful of dirt was turned over. Let me back up a second. The more I've thought about this since this issue was discussed in Juneau a couple of weeks ago, the more convinced I am that there's just no question that FERC is going to take control over this project and this Port Authority project. And by that I mean both the pipeline and the LNG terminal. Start for a second with the LNG terminal. I just happened to pull off on the web this morning a summary done by Greenberg Traurig on the Energy Policy Act of 2005. One of the things the Energy Policy Act of 2005 did was strengthen a lot FERC's control over LNG facilities, and it took authority away from the states. And what they have done, and this is, I'll quote Greenberg Traurig statement here. It says, quote, "The Act amends the NGA by granting the Commission the exclusive authority to approve or deny applications for the siting, construction, expansion, and operation of LNG terminals." So with regard to the LNG terminal, I don't think there's any question that FERC will have authority and will do all those aspects of the siting, construction, expansion, oversight necessary. With regard to the pipeline itself, I understand the Port Authority's arguments. They're saying that because the Natural Gas Act says that a municipality is not subject to the Natural Gas Act, that means that they can construct this pipeline and evade FERC authority, and will not come under FERC authority. Well, I just feel that's a totally incorrect reading of the Natural Gas Act, because the Natural Gas Act also says in other sections that it has exclusive authority over sales of gas in interstate commerce and the transmission of gas in interstate commerce. Now, if you step back and think about it logically, how could someone, what FERC is saying is that you and Muni are not subject to our Natural Gas Act authority. However, if you choose to do those things that are within our jurisdiction, you will come within our jurisdiction. Think if someone used the example of that Long Beach case a couple weeks ago. Suppose the city of Long Beach decided it was going to take and build a 30-inch pipeline from Texas into California to supply California with natural gas. Does anyone for a moment think that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission would sit by and say no, because Long Beach is a municipality, they can build a pipeline and engage in transmission and not be subject to our authority? There are some cases that are analogous to that, certainly not on the scale that I just hypothesized, but directly analogous to that, and FERC has asserted jurisdiction. So I can't for a minute think of how a 48-inch or diameter going down to Valdez pipeline and then going into interstate commerce would not be subject to FERC's jurisdiction. But to answer your original question, Senator, exactly the timing of when the clash will take place, if you will, is not known.
Mr. Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me give a little bit of background on this issue. Again, this is an issue that we think is advantageous to the state. We think regulation, in-state regulation by RCA is good for Alaska. We met with FERC General Counsel, Assistant General Counsel, about 4 years ago in Washington. We sat down, went through the project, laid it all out, and at that time explained that we felt we were FERC exempt based on the definition of natural gas under Section 2 of the National Gas Act. At that time, we were advised, well, they didn't necessarily agree with that, and we were somewhat surprised by that. By the time we got back to the hotel, we'd received an email from FERC saying, you know, we may have misspoke. Should probably talk to our general counsel, which we did. And at that time, he verbally said, yeah, I think you're probably right. This is a huge issue. This is not going to be resolved by phone conversations and you know, sort of, I think this is the way it's going to be. There's two ways of, you know, since then, of course, we retained legal counsel with Hogan and Hartson, who's taken the, you know, researched this and done a thorough analysis of this and has come to the conclusion that we are FERC exempt. And the purpose of that was merely to expedite the loan guarantee process. You know, one option we have available would be certainly what you typically, when you feel you're FERC exempt, you can go and get a declaratory order that you are FERC exempt. We're not intending to do that. We're planning to sit down with FERC in the next 30 days and discuss this with them and find out, you know, is this going to be a long, drawn-out battle? If it is, we may need to rethink that. We're not looking for a fight with FERC. We're looking for expediting a project in the best interest of the state. So we appreciate the work done by the administration with their legal counsel on this. We appreciate their position, and we would like to be able to continue to discuss it in D.C. with the administration legal counsel. We want the right answer. We're not out to battle with FERC. We're out to expedite a project. So right. We think this. We have every reason to believe that we can, but we're not going to get in some long protracted battle with FERC.
I can't speak for the other members. For myself, I'm just trying to get an idea. It seems to me if I look at Dr. Finicu's report to us, the advantage that your project would have would be in terms of net present value. You could get gas to market 3 years earlier if all the hurdles are cleared in the time frame involved. And I think that's probably the question that, from a public policy standpoint, for me, that I'm trying to determine is I want to believe that you guys could be FERC exempt. Nobody, I don't wish FERC on anybody, but could it happen? And if it doesn't happen, does the economic advantage disappear, Mr. Walker?
Yeah, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. We look at our 3 year, and actually that's fairly conservative. We think it's perhaps more than 3 years. Advantage as a result of the work done by Yukon Pacific Corporation. It's not FERC related. It's really the work that's been done, the field work, the permits that have been obtained, the soil samples, the core samples, all the air quality data that's been collected for over 10 years. That's where we see our 3 years. Whether it's FERC regulated or not, we don't hinge our 3 years on FERC regulation. We think the FERC regulation is added benefit on top of what's been done. But, you know, I know $150 million in the scale of things isn't a lot of money, but it's the time that was expended in gathering data that no amount of money can go out and expedite gathering of environmental data. So we think it's the work done by Yukon Pacific Corporation that largely, if not totally, creates that three-plus-year advantage.
And I think part of what I'm looking at, trying to determine as well, Mr. Walker, is, okay, if we do end up with a commercial agreement of some kind that says we're going to have a larger pipe, and I realize that's just an option at this point, the larger pipe to Delta that's anticipated to be able to carry downstream down the road larger amounts and the 1.2 down to Valdez. Isn't some of this permitting the certificate of convenience? Isn't that all going to be kind of tied together? And wouldn't that be kind of on the same timeline as far as the permits from necessary to get from Prudhoe Bay to at least to Delta? Are you anticipating that there would be two different certificates of public convenience, or would it be one? How would that all come together?
Well, on the FERC side, we're not sure that there would be what there would be for our project based on what we believe, and that's what we will sit down and discuss with FERC. I mean, it certainly appears that FERC has every desire. When we met with them in the past and last year when they came to Alaska and met with us, that they want to see a project move as quickly as possible. They also are motivated from a national energy policy standpoint to expedite it as well. So that's what we will sit down with them and work out. And there certainly has been in the past a stipulated jurisdiction where there's some question whether there is jurisdiction or not. We're going to do what is going to be most expeditious towards this project. And so we don't think it would be two certificates. We think that if there's any at all, it would be one. But again, we're going to work with FERC. Most regulatory agencies don't voluntarily waive jurisdiction. We understand that, but we also understand they can certainly create an obstacle for us, and we don't wish that upon us or anybody's project. So we're going to work with them.
Mr. Whitaker, then Senator Wagner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to reemphasize what was, I think, a prescient point that was made yesterday by Mr. Shipkoff. Downstream regulatory regime is FERC controlled. It is in process. That is happening as we speak. Every receiving terminal in the U.S. will be FERC controlled and regulated. And so the downstream, anything downstream of Valdez, it's understood. That is for control. We've had that discussion with them. We have not disagreed.
Somebody puts themselves on hold.
But we have not disagreed with them with regard to upstream regulation. That is yet to be determined. Engaging in that process and have every intention of continuing to do so.
Okay. Mr. Shipkoff, Senator Wagner first.
Go ahead.
Mr. Shipkoff, we're on point here, right?
Yeah.
Shipkoff, and then go ahead.
Clarification for the record. The terminal that we're looking at in our base case, which is Costa Azul, is regulated by CRE.
Right. I think that is clear. Those that are in the United States are FERC regulated. Okay, Mr. Marks.
Well, one big issue that hinges, that's an issue here is the EIS that Yukon Pacific did 20 years ago. It was for a non-FERC project. It's 20 years old. It was for a different project than being proposed here. Clearly, if this project is under FERC regulation, there's a very strong case that a new EIS be required, which I believe would add 2 years to the time frame that the Port Authority has proposed here. In addition, I'm not a NEPA expert, but it just feels to me that a 20-year-old EIS is going to be considered out of date for the NEPA process.
Okay.
Senator, if I may add a point to that.
Mr. Toomey, go ahead.
Clearly what Roger is saying is correct, because implicit in the 2004 Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline Act is that thought, because they have specific provisions within that act for the timing of EISs. And if the old EIS was sufficient, obviously you wouldn't need to write in the statute the timing and scope of any new EIS.
Okay. Mr. Walker.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And those consultants that are familiar with the NEPA process, are familiar with the permits, have advised us that they would need, there would need to be an update, but do not believe that there would need to be a beginning to start over again. You know, whether the project is FERC regulated or not, you know, the process is the same as far as obtaining the right-of-way application, the EIS, all that process is the same. So, we don't think that's the case. I don't think I can add anything more to that. It just
right. Senator Wagner.
Roger asked and kind of answered part of my question. The other part of my question goes to the permits that you have. I believe you have an option on those permits, is that right?
That's correct.
And one of those permits is siting for the LNG facility itself in Valdez. Has there been any study by your group or anybody else on that siting since the, I think there's been some changes in the industrial standards and the recommendations on siting size and acreage to site projects since they had the explosion in Algeria a few years ago. Has anybody looked at that to see what effect that might have on your siting and your permit in Valdez?
Mr. Walker.
We've asked that question, and we've been advised that because if we were going in, that our permits do not, for the siting, comply with the exclusionary zone, et cetera, as required. So we don't think that we need to go out and get a separate permit from what we have already on that.
Okay. One other question. If you don't obtain a commercial contract for gas, then has there been any interest showed by the three majors in the right-of-ways that you currently control with the option? Or is there any discussion of that? I'm just thinking of any way, if, no matter what project we see come down the line, the faster we get it built, the less it's going to cost us. So has there been any discussion or has anybody talked about perhaps with other companies, if you don't come to a commercial agreement within a certain period of time, them taking over your option to purchase those right-of-way permits?
Ms. Walker.
Mr. Chairman, there have been no discussions that I've been a party to about that as far as the now there have been discussions, on, I think publicly stated by TransCanada, that what they have is certainly available for in-state portion. But we've not been approached by anybody on our and our option is as you correctly state, is an exclusive option. So they would need to we would need to be party to that discussion, and we have not to date.
Thank you. Other questions on topic? Anything else having to do with the with FERC, so we can let Mr. Toomey go if necessary. Mr. Mark?
Not on this topic.
On this topic. FERC topics? Mr. Toomey, thank you for being with us this morning. Is there anything else you'd like to add to the conversation?
Just one quick point. I believe it was Mr. Walker that said that we believe we are FERC exempt. What I was saying is not necessarily inconsistent with that. They can be FERC exempt in the sense they are a municipality and qualify, and I don't have legal opinion on it. Assuming they are exempt because they are considered a municipality, quote-unquote, under the law, it does not follow that when they engage in other FERC jurisdictional activities, such as a pipeline that transports gas and interstate commerce, that they don't then become subject to FERC's jurisdiction. And I think I mentioned the California energy crisis analogy 2 weeks ago, Senator, and I think that's directly applicable here. Where munis engaged in the California short-term markets, which are FERC-regulated, and then FERC, therefore, subjected them to refunds on some overcharge issues. The munis claimed that they were exempt because they are munis, and FERC said, no, you came to our party, so to speak. Once you came to our party, you have to abide by the rules. And I think that's what the situation is here. But thank you, Senator, for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that clarification because it brings up a good point. Because we are a municipal entity, we can become FERC regulated if we do certain activities outside of our state. We have retained our involvement and our role very very succinctly to remain within that FERC exemption. So yes, if we did activities outside of the state, move gas out of the state to another state, we could create a FERC regulatory jurisdiction over us. We're very, very aware of that. We know where the boundaries are, and we believe we are well within those boundaries. So I don't think Mr. Toomey and I disagree on that issue.
So is the boundary at Valdez before it gets on the ship? Is that where the boundary is?
The sale would take place in the state of Alaska.
The sale would take place in the state of Alaska, or the transfer of ownership of the molecules takes place before it leaves the state of Alaska?
That's where the boundary is, Mr.
Boundary
Chair.
Is?
That's correct.
Okay. So you would not then be involved as the Port Authority in the transportation as far as the ships are concerned?
As far as ownership of the ship or ownership of the gas in the transportation process, no.
Thank you. Mr. Dickinson?
Mr. Chairman, if I might ask a question perhaps for the head of the FERC attorneys, it may be my misunderstanding here because I'm not even an attorney, let alone a FERC attorney.
Mr. Toomey, you're still with us?
Yes, I am, Senator.
Thank you. Go ahead.
My understanding is the issue drawn about where the gas is going to end up, or does it look at it? I mean, I don't know, does it draw boundaries such as that within the project, or does it say, gosh, this gas is interstate commerce, therefore this anyone engaged in acts concerning it is under our jurisdiction, or do they say, oh, you're just within the state, so at the state boundary we draw a line?
Mr. Toomey, your opinion?
In my opinion, FERC would look very, very closely at the fact situation that Mr. Walker postulated, and if I understand that, it's that not only are you potentially exempt because you're a muni, but you're going to stay exempt because you're going to sell at the north end of the LNG terminal, and therefore it's all an intrastate situation. To me, that strikes me as somewhat artificial because the gas is going unquestionably in interstate commerce, and by doing a buy-sell at the border, that arguably is an artificial way to evade FERC jurisdiction. And to use an analogy, suppose with my analogy before about building a pipeline from Texas into California, suppose there were just buys and sells at the borders such that each journey in and of itself was arguably intrastate, I think FERC would blow through that argument fairly quickly. So I have a healthy degree of skepticism that FERC is going to say simply because you set up a legal transfer of title at the north end of the terminal, you're going to evade FERC jurisdiction.
Mr. Toomey, who decides? The FERC just asserts it and it goes to court?
Yes. FERC will assert jurisdiction if a hypothetical applicant said, hell no, I'm going to go start building it, then FERC would have to go to court and get an injunction.
Further questions on the FERC matter? Thank you very much, Mr. Toomey. We'll let you resume your day there. Thank you for being with us this morning.
Thanks for inviting me, Senator.
Other topics, Mr. Marks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to address one of the issues directly involving the economic analysis Econ 1 did. You know, a big part of the economics of the LNG project is the shipping costs, and I believe the shipping costs that there was a presentation made on differences the Port Authority economics or assumptions and Econ 1s, and one difference that wasn't there was the shipping costs. So I assume Econ 1 use the shipping costs that the Port Authority is using, and that's assuming that the LNG tankers built domestically in 1980s could be reflagged. The ships in question, back in around when those ships were built, a quarter of a century ago, Merit had a program in place called the Construction Differential Subsidy Program, or CDS. Everyone recognized that U.S. shipyards were uncompetitive with shipyards worldwide, and there was in the public interest, it was decided that subsidies would be provided to domestic shipyards to build ships under this program,
But part of the deal was, once they're built, you could not compete in a domestic trade. As soon as the ships were built, they were reflagged to a foreign trade, and they couldn't come back. And the Jones Act itself is quite clear that if you have a domestically built Jones Act ship, but it's reflagged and goes into foreign trade, you cannot reflag it back into the Jones Act trade. Now, you can get potential temporary waivers that are available administratively for purposes of national defense and for passenger ships, but in the case of commercial activity such as this, it can only be reflagged back into the Jones Act trade through an explicit act of Congress. And that's no simple thing. We actually had a report done on just the political climate of having that done. It's on our website. I have a copy here. I'd be happy to, you can distribute to the committee. It was done by the firm of Wilson Gillette and Company in Washington, who are a internationally reputable maritime economics firm. And they looked at this issue and about the possibility of getting these ships reflagged into the Jones Act trade. And, once it becomes an act of Congress, the shipping industry has massive political clout, and there would be massive resistance from the unions, the shipyard unions, to having this done. And the shipyards have done a very good job of having a presence in at least every coastal state, and have the ear of every congressman and senator in those states. So their conclusion was very, very, very unlikely you could get these ships reflagged into the Jones Act trade. Again, here's a copy of the report for the committee. And what ensues from that is that if you want to do this project, you're going to have to build new ships in the U.S. There hasn't been an LNG ship built in the U.S. in 25 years, there would be a huge learning curve. And I think we're talking probably at least another $1 billion to the cost of the LNG project and additional timing to getting the project done. And I think this, if that factor has been put in the economic analysis, I believe it's highly likely it would negate any possible net present value advantage that was depicted in the analysis.
Mr. Walker?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple things. Well, when we need expertise, we retain, I'm not a FERC attorney, we retain FERC, the best FERC counsel we can find in Washington, D.C. I'm not a maritime attorney. We retain and work with the best maritime counsel in Washington, D.C. They've advised us that the reflagging process does require an act of Congress. It certainly does. We've been approached by the maritime unions. We have received an MOU from the maritime unions, from MEBA and SIU, to work with us in this reflagging process. They are anxious to put their people to work. Normally, if you go into to obtain a Jones Act waiver, you have maritime unions opposing that, as well as U.S. shipyards. When you're reflagging a U.S. ship, already built U.S. ship, the U.S. shipyards typically don't get involved. That leaves the maritime unions. We have a good working relationship with the maritime unions. Hang on a second, Roger. Don't get too excited here. When we met with AMEBA approaches initially, it was to obtain a Jones Act waiver. That was at a time when we were looking at doing that. Since then, we've decided that's, Hawaii has obtained that through their delegation and administration. We didn't feel that was going to happen, and so we said, well, let's not go for a Jones Act waiver. Let's look at reflagging. And all this, in addition, of course, is the proposal, as we heard from the president of TOTE, something that they had proposed, which I think makes a lot of sense, is bringing a foreign shipyard, a builder of LNG ships, to a U.S. shipyard, bring that technology to a U.S. shipyard, and build those in a U.S. shipyard if that is, in fact, necessary. That's sort of plan B somewhat. And they believe there are significant savings in that. Again, a sort of a unique solution to this issue. I guess I just get a little bit worried that, you know, literally everything we come back with the IRS ruling, and those that would benefit the most from its administration quickly challenge it. We look at the ways we can expedite the project on FERC, and quickly, you know, your consultants, the legislature consultant, has been very cooperative with us. Mr. Scheffler has been very helpful with us, met with us, worked with us on this issue, and he doesn't particularly disagree with this. I mean, I'm trying to put words in his mouth. He testified before you. But this what we hear this morning is what we've been up against for the last 4 years, and it's just tiring. It's just tiring that we have this, and we have, you know, we don't make this stuff up. We go and sit down with the best. We've had multiple meetings with attorneys with Blank Rome in Washington, D.C. about the process and the steps and what we need to do, and so we met with the president of MEBA several times in Washington, D.C. So, I mean,
while it may be tiring for you, it's the first time some of us in the legislature have heard it, so that's why we're here.
And I think for that reason, I'm glad it's being discussed. I'm very pleased it's being discussed. But I guess I'm, you know, these are. I tell you you want some hurdles to tackle. Go out and convince someone to put in $8 million into a project. We don't have any gas. I mean, we have spent many years climbing very tall mountains, and we have been successful in that process. So these we don't see as showstoppers at all. We believe we've done our homework, and we believe that there's good reason to believe that the shipping costs will be what we have in our model, and that's why it's in our model. So,
Mr. Shipkoff, then on point, Roger, be next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to give you some background on this shipping issue, we, the Port Authority, were approached by the company that owns the ships in question. It's a U.S. company with shareholders, 75% shareholder of the largest LNG shipper in the world, owner of ships. The U.S. company that owns the ships in question has been in the LNG shipping business for 25 years. We'd like to think that they know their business a little bit better than we do. They approached us with a full understanding of what the project we are talking about is and what the legal requirements of reflagging their own ships, which they, of course, got flagged out of the Jones Act trade when they were employed abroad, entails. The process has already begun. We're working very closely with the company that owns the ships, and the process the process of reflagging them has begun. If the feeling on the part of the ship owner was that this is a prohibitive process, I don't think that we would be wasting our time spending meetings in Washington, D.C., discussing about what exactly the process entails and how long it takes. The timeline that was outlined to us was a reasonable case. It takes about a year for the process to go through, to reflect ships. Worst case scenario, 2 years. And that process has begun.
And that takes an act of Congress?
Yes.
Mr. Marks.
Again, I would encourage the committee to read the report.
We'll get copies of that to everyone, too.
And it's on our website, too. The union Mr. Walker mentioned, MEBA, is discussed in the report. The author of the report considers MEBA a fairly insignificant union in the big picture politically without a lot of influence. They basically represent officers on the ships. There's two other very significant unions, the Seafarers International Union and the American Maritime Officers Association, that they believe would offer considerable political resistance to try and reflag the ships. I'm not an expert, but this is what the expert thinks. If this is something the committee wishes to pursue, we could get Mr. Wilson, who authored their report, to address the issue in detail.
Mayor Whitaker.
Thank you. I want to pick up where Mr. Walker left off with regard to hurdles that we have continued to cross. One of the biggest hurdles that we have now crossed is dealing with a very uncooperative administration. You've witnessed that. If there is a problem with HERC, with FERC, one would assume that the state would be cooperative and helpful in dealing with that FERC issue. If there is a problem with Jones Act shipping, one would assume that the state would be cooperative and helpful dealing with that issue. If one were dealing with IRS issues, one would assume that the state would be cooperative and helpful in dealing with that issue. Instead, what we found is what you're witnessing, Mr. Chairman, continual, incredible resistance. And I am astounded that this administration would speak with regard to a political climate in Washington, D.C., with regard to its effect on the project. I don't think they are experts with regard to political climate. And so I will say this, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate very much the opportunity to come before the committee. I appreciate very much your fairness. And had we received this type of cooperation throughout the process, I can tell you the Port Authority project and Alaska's gas going to market would be much further along than it is today.
Thank you, Mr. Porter.
I actually agree with much of what Mayor Whitaker said. I think that as we identify issues, we need to, and I've been a pretty strong proponent of moving this, of it, Port Authority's project into a project management style of process with a hire project manager and look at the hurdles and begin to work toward solving those hurdles. I think the state should financially support and verbally support that methodology. When we found out that, for example, and part of it is just making sure that we're all accurately on the same page. In previous presentations that the Port Authority has made to the legislature and to the public, reflagging is a good example. Their statements have been, all we need to do is reflag it, and we're working on that. What would be helpful to the state is to sit down and say, one, I think you guys did not understand that it took an act of Congress. I think that today is the first time that they've actually put that in the public record or acknowledged that. We knew that all along. But if that is the case, what we need to do is to lay out this as a project, look at all the hurdles, and then begin to methodically bite off one of those for each hurdle at a time. The Maritime Union's information, I think, is accurate. I think that that does not mean that it is a showstopper. I think it means that you approach those other two unions, or three or four, actually. I think the report actually may even list eight unions. The report is accurate in terms of what they have, in our minds, what they have in terms of support. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't move forward on trying to get the additional support until you fail. I mean, the goal is to continue to move the project forward, work with those other unions. The state should support them working with those other unions. Because the key here is what we talked about yesterday. You've got to bring this project down to make it commercial to get the unit cost of development down to get to the point where somebody's going to ship gas on your line. And that brings me back to one additional point, and that is there's two issues. Either it's not going to be black or white, but I'm going to lay it out in black and white because it's going to be some area gray in between. But let's assume it was black or white, whether either it was competitive or it was not competitive. Okay, if it's competitive, you're going to have somebody shipping gas on that line. If you get it there two or three years earlier, then everybody wins. If it's not competitive, what you have is a situation where you must make sure that it gets there two or three years earlier. The person that's shipping gas on that line must agree with you for that, because what they're going to do is they're going to sell gas, they're going to have an FT contract, they're going to sell gas early for 3 years, then they're going to sell gas at a loss for 30 years. They're banking on that incremental time of those 3 years, because otherwise you'd be shipping your gas down the more competitive line through Canada. That's why the first and foremost thing this project has to do is get competitive. Because otherwise you're setting up yourself in a differential where you've got you're banking on it, and you lose if you don't bring this project on substantially early. And that's why this project should work on all the hurdles, make sure that you're actually viable, and then work on the elements of the project, whether it's subsidies from Congress on tankers again or whatever it happens to be, but bring this project down to where it becomes commercial.
Not all of my colleagues believe in net present value either. So we'll talk about that. Senator Wagner.
Well, I've not mentioned this in public before, but 2 years ago, and it's not a slam on the Port Authority or anything else, but I think there's a clarification needs to be made. and it's up to the Port Authority to make that clarification, because 2 years ago when I was in Washington, D.C. at Energy Conference, I had just met with Senator Stevens, and I think there were five or six other legislators with me in the room. And at that time, we were talking about a waiver of the Jones Act, and I asked Senator Stevens if that was going to be possible for the Port Authority to get a Jones Act waiver, and he said, no. He said, that is not going to happen. It's never happened. It won't happen. So I think now with the reflagging of these ships, you need to do a lot of work with Senator Stevens, because he will be a key to getting the reflagging done, I would imagine. And I plan, I'll be meeting him tomorrow in a couple of different locations, and I plan to discuss this with him, because it would be very important, this project, you know, if that were possible and if he were swinging behind it. And I attended a luncheon right after I met with Senator Stevens, and Meeble was there, and they said, oh, yeah, we can get the Jones Act waiver, there's no problem. But I felt it was kind of disingenuous of them to come into the room and say that after I had just met with the President Pro Tem in his chambers, and he said, there's absolutely no way you're going to get a Jones Act waiver.
Mr. Walker.
That needs to be pursued and fleshed out.
Right. Mr. Walker.
Senator Wagner, you're absolutely correct. And that was one of the reasons that we have we looked at that initially. We're certainly aware of Senator Stevens' position on that, and so we've adjusted accordingly. And you know, is that a quote change to our project? I guess it is. Is it a advisable change? We think it is. And one of the things that we suffer from is that sometimes the more information we put out, sometimes we discover this is not always used in our best interest. You know, so it's disheartening in some respects, because we are an entity that we do. You're entitled to know what we know.
Don't feel like the Lone Ranger.
And I know that. I know I'm preaching to the choir on that. But I'm sorry if I'm sounding a bit whiny this morning on that issue. But you know, we get excited about what we bring into it. We get excited when we get an IRS ruling. We get excited when we get a determination from an indication that we're FERC exempt. And I know that we have to be realistic and Steve Porter has been very helpful in his approach with us, and we appreciate that. But that issue, the Jones Act issue, is an issue that we have addressed fully. We did receive a resolution of support from the Seafarers International recently. So we think we're lining up the appropriate issues, and we certainly plan to address this with Senator Stevens. Remember, Senator Stevens was a huge help to this project and the loan guarantee. If it had not been for Senator Stevens, that would not have happened for us. So, but thank you for your comment.
Porter, this actually ends up being a follow-up to Bill Walker's statement about utilization of information. I think that there is a level of mistrust out there right now. It is hindering our communications. There have been times when we've asked for additional information to try to understand the project, and we've received statements that is confidential, and I think partially because they're afraid that we'll use it against them. And that is not our intent. We do plan on trying to figure out how to understand the project fully and how to move it forward, but it does require us to get to the point where we trust each other a little bit more and share information.
And we only trust you because you used to live in Fairbanks, but we have a little question about your judgment after you left.
My apologies.
But, okay, go ahead. Mr. Shipkoff.
I just want to make a clarification on one of the points that Mr. Marks brought up. The CDS, the construction differential subsidy for the ships in question, has been repaid. The condition of their being flagged out of the trade. So
it has been repaid, you said?
Yes. That's what they have to do to flag them out.
All right. Other questions on the Jones Act or on the shipping side of it? I mean, very interesting discussion here. Points I had never that had never been raised before, in at least to me. Members, any questions here so far? Okay, next issue. What else were we talking about this morning, Mr. Marks?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just like to, I guess, bring up one issue that was, I think going back to Mr. Finese's presentation, page 20, IRRs. And, you know, I looked at those, and 66.9% and 74.8% are You know, I look at those, and you know, those are very high. And I know Mr. Fernisa doesn't put a lot of deference on the IRR, and kind of I guess didn't put a lot of importance on it. But you know, a lot of people will focus on these numbers looking high. But I believe the way he calculated them mechanically was the producers. You know, instead of paying for the pipeline up front, in terms of, you know, IRRs are based on your cash flows. And you could calculate it, you know, if the producers, you know, put up the $25 billion up front, that's one way of calculating the IRR. And it's, if you do that, it's sort of low. But if you had them paying the tariff over time, since that spreads out the payment over time, it makes the IRR high. The way we've looked at the issue of calculating the IRR, even when producers do pay the tariff, is we believe, you know, the way corporations look at that is because paying the tariff over time represents a long-term, a sizable firm transportation commitment, that financially we believe what corporations do is capitalize that commitment up front, and so it becomes sort of like they pay the money, you know, as cash up front, you get the lower IRR that you get as if they paid for it up front with cash. And I just wondered if Mr. Fenizza would want to address that issue.
Dr. Fenizza.
I was wondering whether I would get to talk this morning. Glad Mark did. He pointed to page 20, where I showed some IRRs when comparing how the two models that I was evaluating, the NYSA model and ours, was performing. And I use that nowhere else, as you know, because I don't feel that in this case the IRR is going to be helpful. Now, if we really calculated again the way that Roger suggests, I think that's a reasonable way of looking at it, but I still wouldn't use it. And one of the anomalies I'd like to just argue about is, let's suppose you calculated the IRR the way it's just been suggested, and you had a project that started 3 years before the highway line, as proposed by AGPA, and you got an IRR. Then all of a sudden you discovered that it has a one-year delay in the LNG project, and you move it 1 year to the right, so to speak. Your IRR will actually go up. Is that something that you would expect to be helpful as a rule of thumb? I have a better IRR because the project pieces get closer together. So that would not be useful. And for that reason, I didn't bother reporting that.
Mr. Mark?
Yeah, I agree with Mr. Fenizza that the IRR has limited applicability. It is an important metric for just one specific question about being able to repay your investors. But I guess I would just caution the committee and the public to not look at a 66.9% IRR and go away and say, wow, this is fabulous, because if you capitalize commitment, it's much, much lower than that, in the probably the high teens or something like that.
Mr. Shipkoff, go ahead. Dr. Fenizza.
You notice, this was not for the analysis of their project. This was the analysis of, did their model come about the same result? Of course, we would have put in the PTU feeder, the GTP, and other things in the upstream. And then our model does that. And I'm guessing the numbers would not be in the teens. Well, they might be in the teens, maybe 19.9, or I bet you they'd be in the 20s.
Okay.
So it's still, I would think it would show a robust.
Right.
But again,
Mr. Shipkoff and Mr. Vantai.
If I understand Mr. Marx's argument correctly, he's suggesting that the proper way of looking at the returns to the producers is to include, on an integrated basis, all of the midstream components, assuming that they will be doing the investment into the midstream components, into the overall return. The conceptual problem with that approach is that it is blending together two types of projects of a very different nature. It is blending a midstream project with midstream types of risk and midstream types of expected return on capital, with upstream projects, which have a different risk profile. Midstream projects generally attain lower levels of return because of the nature of those types of investments. They're also regulated, you know, entities like TransCanada, both in Canada and the U.S., and other pipeline companies get the equity rates of return, you know, 12, 14%. Those types of returns seem to be satisfactory to them. If you blend the two types of investments together, of course you're going to, the upstream returns are going to be dragged down by the midstream, but you're not blending together two types of investments of a similar nature. Another point that Mr. Mark is saying is that you have to take into account the, and he's talking about capitalizing the commitment by the shippers to for the firm service of the transportation obligation. There is some truth to that, but I think there are some slides that I have seen presented by Dr. Finitza and his colleagues that address very effectively and illustrate very well the economic meaning and the difference, the essential difference between taking what, including the obligation into an integrated project and treating the upstream as separate, but taking into account the commitment to supply gas and to pay the tariff. Tony, I think you know which slides I'm talking about, which show the a graph that shows the A and B area and what is the expected, what are the circumstances under which the obligation on the producers to pay the tariff begins to be burdensome because they have to cover the negative cost of low price minus a tariff that is higher than the price.
Dr. Finitza, and then we'll go to Mr. Van Tuyl.
I think if the argument were, and I agree with what Mr. Shipkoff said, if the argument or the analysis were just simply, in my mind, comparing highway lines against similar projects, I would be engaged in this argument. But I don't think I would like to spend a lot of energy on improving a measure that I don't think would be useful. I mean, a lot of companies may use break-even analysis of stuff. I don't know if that would be useful. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on something that's not going to help this project because it gives anomalous results.
Okay, Mr. Van Tuyl.
Thank you, Chairman. I just wanted to, Roger and others have suggested how producers might look at economics, so I thought it might be appropriate to speak on behalf of the producers directly. And I think the underlying or the critical observation here is that the cost of these shipping commitments, the firm transportation obligations, have to be recognized in looking at project economics or looking at upstream economics. You can't separate upstream from a midstream investment. And the two are linked because of the fact that the upstream owners of the resource only have the midstream investment happening because they make a firm transportation obligation. And that firm transportation obligation has value to those seeking a loan. Therefore, it has a cost to those that make the obligation. Roger's right that it's typical, it's common that in looking at one way to look at the cost of that obligation to capitalize it because it's a simple way to estimate what that cost might be. Mr. Shipkoff is also correct that the nature of the two streams of cash flows may have different risks. So if you wanted to do it more rigorously, you could do some kind of a dual discounting approach to reflect the profiles of each of those obligations. The bottom line is either way you look at it, there's other ways that companies look at it, but you can't ignore it. And it seems that much of this analysis in looking at the upstream returns simply ignores that fundamental commitment made by the resource owners, and that commitment is a real cost to the project.
Further questions, comment? Senator Terrio.
Dave, that type of commitment is made on all the pipelines that you ship on, and you don't own them. So why is it that this one's so different? And we have had conversations going back that, and Exxon was very, very strident that, no, this is, we treat it as a debt. Although we've not been able to find anybody, any independent consultants in the financial markets that indicate that, yeah, it is in fact treated like debt. They've said that it gets noted on the balance sheet, but it's a note. So, and something that's bothered me for quite some time.
Senator Kerrio, this is not unique in evaluation of pipeline projects. It's actually done for every pipeline project that we invest in. There are examples of projects like this, whether it's a pipeline project or LNG projects or whatnot, that aren't just noted. They're actually end up on the balance sheet. They are classified under GAAP's international GAAP as debt-like payments. And the appropriate treatment of those, whether they end up specifically on the balance sheet, noted as footnotes, even if they're noted as a footnote, when you go in and sit down with your auditors and do the review of your financials, then they treat it like a debt. So the fact of the matter is they are debt-like payments. How you actually calculate those in project economics is where you can come up with some different methods. But they're real obligations, and therefore they need to be accounted for.
Sparks?
To follow up on that point, I would be happy to supply the committee with documents from GAAP and Moody's and actual chapters from financial textbooks on how long-term purchase obligations like a tariff are treated financially. And again, as Mr. Van Tile said, you know, the reason these don't show up on the balance, I mean, you could go to the 10-K for all three companies and find in their notes where their purchase obligations, where these tariffs are capitalized in the notes. And the reason they aren't on the balance sheet is per GAAP standards, or per GAAP, standards, you don't put it on your balance sheet unless the commitment involves either like 90% of the life of the asset or 75% of the value. And in the case of pipelines that have very long lives or multiple subscribers, you won't meet that qualification. But just because something is off balance sheet debt does not mean it's not debt. It's debt with a capital D. It's absolutely an obligation. And again, I'd be happy to supply the committee with a plethora of documents that substantiates that.
Mr. Dickinson.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I am the only CPA at the table from my FERC attorney or something, and I would like to point out something that we often say, and you'll see it in fine print, and it says the notes are an integral part of the financial statement. And I think what's most important, there's two points that are important here. One of them is what's called balance sheet impairment. The point is when folks look, and I realize that a lot of these companies are in very cash-rich positions now, but when you're looking at long-term financing, you're looking at options and what it does, what those commitments do over time. So I think the notion of, the cash hasn't come out of the pocket, but the effect on the company is the same because you've made the commitment. And the second related point to that is, speaking not now as an accountant, I mean, it's how financial analysts, including the folks on the board or whoever has to make the commitment, look at those commitments and how they take that information and look at it and say, what does this do to the company's position? And if you misanalyze debts or commitments, you have misanalyzed the project. So I think it's very important that we don't get caught up on the accounting treatment issues, which really are, as Roger said, have to do with a couple of FASB rulings when off-balance sheet financing started to be a popular form of financing in this country and focused more on the financial implications of making the kind of commitments.
Mr. Kelly, Representative Kelly.
Just since we haven't heard from Dan until now on this issue, do you support pitching IRR over the bank and using the cash flow analysis like Dr. Panizza has recommended?
Mr. Dickinson.
I don't believe Dr. Panizza is suggesting that you pitch it over the bank. I think what he's saying is each of these financial metrics has a place. The ultimate judgments, the reason why they're boards that make judgments and don't rely on a bunch of people with spreadsheets is because you have to balance those and figure out which metric and which criteria is important. So I think part of the issue here, and I think Dr. Benitez, I don't want to put words in his mouth, is you have to be very careful about what, depending on what you were comparing, IRR becomes a lower or a better or a worse measure. I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, IRR has more to do with when you evaluate projects and you decide whether they'll meet your hurdle rate, you have your cost of capital, those kinds of questions. It becomes more problematic when you're comparing projects because you have what's called the reinvestment problem. If you have a single project with a very high investment rate, the assumption is, I should like Dr. Benitez to talk about this, he's probably more familiar with it, can explain it better than I can, but the assumption is that as you throw cash off, it's continuing to find an equal investment. But if you throw cash off and you can't get that investment, the neat spreadsheet model doesn't necessarily reflect what's going to happen in the real world. So I think the point I would say is we have to, what each metric does is very important, and you have to make sure you're doing the right comparison.
Dr. Finita?
I'd like to commend Dan Dixon on his ability to explain difficult terms. He's the only accountant I know that can actually do that.
I think those are very good points, and they are accurate and part of my feelings as well. And especially when you get numbers that are way out of whack with your opportunity cost, they can be funny. Another problem with this project, if you can kind of visualize a little graph here, is you find a project being the Y line. Let's suppose part of it started up in 2013, let's just make it wider. One started in 2018. You have these cash flows, you have these big investments, and then positives, and then all of a sudden you have another one that comes negative. And whenever you have a cash flow scheme that is not has all these bimodal, trimodal things, you can get multiple solutions. You just get crazy numbers. And of course, you can pick the number that supports your case. You can pick the one that doesn't support your case. So I think it's better to avoid using that measure on this type of comparison to avoid people choosing the numbers they like.
Mr. Shipkoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would agree with Mr. Dickinson that the accounting treatment of these obligations is somewhat of a secondary importance to the cash flow effect of in analyzing a project's competitiveness, and I believe that Mr. Van Tile will confirm that. Certainly, I'm not arguing that the commitments under firm service obligations have to be ignored in the analysis. They have to be taken into account. But I believe that there's a fundamental. It's not the same to say that making those commitments is the same as if a company invests into the midstream infrastructure. And I would suggest once again that difference is very well illustrated. The economic significance of that difference is very well illustrated in some of the slides that the legislature has seen on previous occasions presented by Econ 1. Part of the reason upstream investments tend to be riskier than midstream investments is because they, on many occasions, have to make those types of firm service obligations. It's in effect, the upstream shippers are leveraging against the midstream infrastructure. That increases their risk. Therefore, the expected return on capital is higher, which is why we're saying that upstream investments have to be treated in the economic analysis differently. Higher discount rate, higher expectation of return. But it's not the same as saying that the obligation to provide firm transportation service is the same as investing in the stream infrastructure.
Are there questions on this point? Let's take about a Ms. Marks.
Just one more. I mean, just one on this issue. If a producer has a choice of either laying out the money itself for the project or having a third party do it and paying a tariff, if you just looked at the cash flows straight, what you'll get is again a very high IRR if you're paying the tariff off over time, and what you if you think about the tariff structure, it's kind of like a debt. You're sort of like someone else pays for the pipeline up front, and you're paying it off over time. And lo and behold, you're just unadjusted, your IRR goes way up. Well, there's an old adage in finance that you can't make a bad project good by borrowing money. And unadjusted, this is what it shows, that if you just go from a situation where instead of paying off the $25 billion to build the project, you incur the obligation and stop there, your IRR has gone way up. And what you say, gee, we've made a bad project good by borrowing money. And there's two reasons that doesn't work. And number one, again, like we've talked about, these long-term FT commitments are debt. They impact the credit worthiness and the credit capacity of the company, and that is why they're capitalized as if the money was paid up out front. In addition, you know, people compare the IRR to a hurdle rate, and this hurdle rate is a weighted average cost of capital. Well, if your tariff payments include both the principal and interest, you're paying off the interest part of the weighted average cost of capital. So what your hurdle rate becomes is no longer the weighted average cost of capital, but your cost of equity itself. And so when people generally look at IRRs and their hurdle rate is the weighted average cost of capital, if you have a cash flows that represent include the payment of the debt, your whole standard of comparison is off base, and so you no longer have an apples-apples comparison with other projects.
Then Mr. Shipkoff?
As Senator Terrio pointed out, upstream production companies engage in firm transportation service agreements with third parties all the time. This project, nobody's suggesting that if a third party provided the midstream service to the upstream producers, this is going to be a unique situation. They engage in that kind of activity all the time, and the inherent increase in riskiness to them because, in fact, they're leveraging off the midstream infrastructure is reflected into the risk profile of the upstream investment. So when you're looking at the very high returns of upstream projects or the relatively higher returns of upstream projects, that inherently has been taken into account. But just to take a step back and say, okay, let's just ignore this whole issue and say, let's roll in all of the midstream infrastructure into this project and see what happens to these returns. I think we have seen from some of the work that has been previously done by Econ One that the returns, even when you blend it with the midstream, still appear to be very high. So,
okay.
Either way, I'm not sure what the issue is.
Mr. Van Tile.
Yeah, earlier, thank you, Chairman Seekins. Earlier, Mr. Shipkoff presumed my agreement with his assertion that the firm transportation obligations were treated different than a cash obligation or a cash stream generated by a project. And I just wanted to be clear that I don't agree with that assertion. They're a debt obligation that our company would be committed to, and it's treated just like any other obligation that we have. And so there's multiple ways you can account for it. Calculating your economics, but it's absolutely accounted for just like any other cash payment.
Thank you. With that, we're going to take a 10-minute break. We'll be back at 20 minutes till 11. Let's stable air. Call the meeting back to order.
Economic calculation. We should have gotten both of them. We should have gotten both of them. If you assume that you can't have it with the three, they've done it.
For the benefit of some folks that are trying to catch airplanes, we're going to try to conclude the meeting by about 11:30 if we can. Other issues that we want to talk about? Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chairman, just to preface, I know that I guess I've been perceived as dumping on this project. My sole concern is I believe the public interest is advanced and maximized when people just understand the complexities of these issues. I talk about the diversion option a little bit.
Go ahead.
You know, as has been pointed out, the price of gas in Asia is generally tied to oil prices, and so at least recently they've been pretty high. And most of the gas in Asia is sold at contract at these prices. But what ensues from that is you know, strangely enough, that the prices in Asia are not set by supply and demand. They're set by oil prices. And so just because prices are high in Japan or Asia does not mean the demand will be there, that you can just go in and sell it at that high price. And so just because prices are there does not open up the possibility of exercising this diversion option. In addition, when occasionally spot cargoes of gas show up in Asia for sale, they're outside the realm of the contract. They're not tied to oil prices. They are actually subject to competition. And again, another dimension of this diversion option is, gee, if Alaska could sell a cargo, why couldn't Qatar or Indonesia or Australia or Sakhalin? And when you get into that dynamic, it's the lowest price bidder that commercializes the gas. Accordingly, you know, I believe that any value that can be realized from a diversion option from Alaska Gas would be very small.
Hey, Mr. Shipkoff?
A couple of things on this. First of all, there I can find the news reports about this, but it was pretty widely reported that during the last winter, Japan was outbidding the U.S. for spot cargoes. They were paying for gas for about $20 per MMBTU because of shortages that they were having. What we're suggesting is that we will be selling it. Those circumstances, yes, Alaska is not going to be the only project that's going to be selling spot cargoes to Japan. We're going to be one of the projects that will have the opportunity to do that, and we have attempted to quantify what's the effect of having that opportunity. But I would more importantly like to draw attention to the fact that Dr. Finis's analysis ignored the value of the option, and it still indicates that the LNG project is very robust.
Shipkoff, answer me a question, and I know you addressed this down in Juneau, but I'm older and I forget some of these things once in a while. If you would, we talked about the effect of long-term shipping commitments and how you could, with a long-term shipping commitment, all of a sudden divert some of that from that buyer or that in that shipping pipe, so to speak, or train or whatever you want to call it, now to Japan, and how would we fill that obligation?
The way it's done contractually typically is that when the seller has the right to divert, normally the seller has to compensate the buyer for any replacement gas costs. In addition, we have, because the seller has to pay the gas from somewhere else, and to the extent that there's a differential to the buyer from obtaining the gas from an alternative source, the buyer who is diverting has to compensate. Sorry, the seller who is diverting has to compensate the buyer for that. In the analysis that we performed, we took into account all the costs that the seller, the LNG project, will have to pay when it's diverting cargoes, including paying for the fixed infrastructure capacity reservation. Because if we're diverting cargoes, spot cargoes to Japan, we will have the regas terminal and the takeaway pipelines not fully utilized. You'll have to pay for that. So we have taken that into account.
Okay. And you still, even with buying gas someplace else, paying for the use of the terminals, you still believe that there's an economic advantage under certain circumstances to diverting the gas?
Exactly. When the price is sufficiently high such that the differential covers more than covers your fixed costs, you will only perform that diversion in those circumstances. And we have looked at the statistical distribution of the prices, and we have estimated how often that situation is likely to arise. And that's how we ran the dollar.
Mr. Porter, then Mr. Dr. Fleet.
Actually, Dave Antonio could probably address this better than I can, but in terms of potential for additional, there's also a potential for additional gas in the wintertime. I mean, just in terms of that issue, if you were in the wintertime, you can actually produce better, so you may exceed your FT contract obligations to be able to move more gas down a pipeline, say, for example. But that's a separate issue, so it doesn't always have to be a trade. You may actually, if you're lucky, at the right season, be able to capture that incremental benefit.
Actually, Mr. Porter is absolutely correct. A lot of the spot trade these days occurs because most LNG plants, through some debottlenecking, can increase their output beyond their contracted capacity. So there's just more LNG available to be sold. But of course, in your baseline analysis, you're not going to assume that you're actually producing more than your initially stated capacity was.
Mr. Porter, then Dr. Fleet. Go ahead, Dr. Fleet.
Okay. I looked at the diversion. You heard what I said yesterday about it, but I looked at the analysis that they did, and I saw a lot of this, these features in there. There's one I wrote a note to ask you, and I didn't, and that was when there's when everyone's trying to enter the market because of this opportunity, did you figure out some way of lowering the price, since that market is probably not a, probably a static market in the case of competition? Did you actually take the price that you would...
The price in the market to which you're diverting?
Yeah.
No, the analysis assumes that you're selling at the average Japanese price. We projected Japanese landed prices on the basis of an assumption of how oil price moves, because contractually they're tied to JCC.
Right.
Now, yes, you may have to take into account some discounts below what the market price is, but we think that the opportunities, when the opportunity to divert arises, that's because there's higher price, there's an opportunity to sell at a higher price because there's some kind of a shortage in Japan that happened last winter. So actually, you're more likely to be selling at a price above the contractual prices that happen at the same time. But yes, you can, you can take a view and take some haircut on what we have calculated, say 10% or 20%. I'm not sure if you want to take some arbitrary approach like that, and I don't have a conceptual problem with that. And as we presented to the committee 3 weeks ago, and as Dr. Finis's analysis shows, we're not relying on the value of the option to make our project economic. We think it's just a gradient, and it becomes an argument how valuable it is, what's the magnitude of that option. But
okay,
it's not something that we inherently need for our project to be economic. We can completely ignore it, and the project still works.
All right. Mr. Porter.
New subject.
Okay.
One of the things we've been kind of looking at is, we've heard that they, talk about the Coastal Azul project, or the three gas facility down there. We understand that they're under a bidding process for their expansion. And as I understand it, their intent was to be, basically went through the bid process, but their intent was to be fully subscribed by the end of the year. And whether or not they're going to get there is, I don't know. But if they are fully subscribed by the end of the year, then that particular window probably closes. And by way of recommendation and question, one is that I think we need to continue to look for what are the options X number of years from now and how to open those doors.
What I can say about this is you have to keep in mind that we are negotiating with them, and we are under confidentiality with them about what their time schedule is. What I can say is that we are in serious negotiations with them about that.
Well, I appreciate that, because as I was from an outsider looking forward, I'm saying, one, if you don't have a gas, you don't have any gas to commit right now, so you're in a position where even though you're still moving your project forward, trying to make it into a commercial project, you don't have the ability to subscribe.
They know what our situation is.
Okay. I just curious about how that was. I know they did. That's why I was kind of trying to figure out how you deal with that.
I'm sure they're tracking you guys' progress just as well. Yeah. The members, questions from members. Let's start looking maybe from the far right with David Guttenberg.
Paying attention and listening. Yeah. Enlightening.
Okay. Representative Stoltz?
I'll stay for a profound closing.
Okay. Representative Samuel?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'd like an answer maybe from one, just an interest time, one Port Authority person and one revenue person, and Dr. Fanitza, and maybe from Mr. Antile. Not being an accountant, a FERC lawyer, or any of those things, but I am a businessman. And if I've got gas, the Constitution says I have to maximize the revenue or maximize the benefit to the state of Alaska, and I'm on the slope, and I either can pay $3.55, which is your number, or I can pay $2.17, which is the number across the continent. Even if they are off by 50%, you guys are right on, and you get the gas, whether we nationalize it or make a deal or whatever it is that you want to do, $3.55 to $2.17. That's the question I can't get around. And the net present value basis, I understand the time, Mayor Whitaker, I understand the timing, but until we get the timing, the whole 5.5B going all down the pipeline, even I think that probably swings the net present value, even although I'll let Dr. Fanitza stick to that, but that's the crux of it. I guess Mr. Porter said to make the project a commercial deal, but I can't get around that yet on the 355 versus the 217. So all of you, one at a time, need to help me with that.
Who wants to start? Mr. Shipkoff or Mr. Walker? Or why don't we let Dave and Kyle start? He looked most urgent.
I guess as we've said before, that's really the focus that we've had to try to deliver gas to market at the lowest possible cost, because we believe that delivers the most value to the owners of the gas, both the producers and the state. That's been our focus. We have, in fact, over the years looked at LNG and tried to make LNG work for Alaska. We were members of the LNG sponsor group. I was as an owner of the LNG sponsor group back years ago. We shifted to looking at the gas pipeline when we realized, penciling it out, that we could actually deliver gas to market in the lower 48 cheaper. That in targeting the Midwest, we could also pipeline gas to the West Coast cheaper than we can deliver it via LNG. And that's been our focus. We can do our best to control the cost of the project. We can't control the price. So that's where our focus is on delivering value. And we think that's also the best way to stimulate future exploration. It gives people an opportunity to deliver new gas to market at the lowest possible cost. And Representative Samuels referenced the $5.5 billion cubic foot a day project, I guess, which would be the 1.2 LNG and the 4.3 gas project. I guess that raises some questions in my mind about, you know, we would then be talking about a fundamentally different gas treatment plant. It's a fundamentally different gas treatment plant to process gas to LNG spec than it would be to process gas to pipeline spec. LNG doesn't tolerate CO2, doesn't tolerate aromatics, so it's a different process, different solvent to remove aromatics. All right.
Follow-up question. Thank you.
Go ahead. Representative Samuels.
A follow-up. Is it possible then to have a DTP on the slope that makes it pipeline quality and a fine-tuning mechanism in Delta? I have no idea how those things work.
Yeah. Representative Samuels, it's possible to treat the gas anywhere along the line. One challenge you would have would be to dispose of the CO2, the additional CO2 that you would take off on the slope. There's multiple options, whether that's through reinjecting in a gas cap or using a municipal solvent for a viscous flood or whatnot. Taking it off downstream would present the CO2 disposal concern, I guess, as an issue. The other concern that the 5.5B project, and maybe this is off point, but the pipeline from North Slope to Delta, again, is fundamentally different than what we had talked about earlier. And we want to have a project that delivers gas at low cost and is expandable. To get all 5.5Bs down to Delta would require us to put in the intermediate compression. The downstream system would therefore no longer be expandable, which we don't think is in the best interest of, again, stimulating exploration. So, very long-winded answer, but again, our focus is on delivering gas at the lowest possible unit cost. We think that's the best way to maximize that.
Okay. Anyone else wanted to comment on that question, Mr. Walker?
I would, and it's a good question. We believe with what we've looked at and the numbers and the we believe our project is very competitive with the highway project. But I guess we approach it a little from a different standpoint. And we sort of draw off of what happened on the TAPS line. We look at the efforts made to have that come through Alaska, and in 73, it was all about coming through. I mean, there was a strong effort for the oil line to go through Canada, and that was defeated. Because we wanted the largest footprint in Alaska, and our delegation was largely responsible for that. We sort of approach it from the same standpoint. The other concern we have is, as we tried to illustrate, and I don't think I did a very good job of it, unfortunately, is that what we see is we're concerned about losing an opportunity for Alaska if we hold out and bet everything on a highway project of which there's no commitment to build. Of which there's a lot of effort to get gas in that market from elsewhere. We're betting everything on one market. Whereas what we're trying to do is show how Alaska can have both the best of both worlds, the best of both markets, and not exclude a market. What we're trying to show is that what we're trying to do is we're trying to enhance and encourage and improve the economics of a highway route by bringing gas through Alaska to South Central for export sooner than later. And at least if we think that's a good thing. And so we do look at the wellhead numbers. We think that is certainly an appropriate yardstick of measurement. We don't think it's the only yardstick of measurement of the maximum benefit for Alaska if we have, if this is pushed out to 2025, 2030, 2035, and Alaska is going to look very, very different. When I look at a project that not our numbers, but Econ One's numbers shows a $6 case, it brings over $4 billion to the state revenues. On a stress case, brings over $2 billion. On a break-even case, brings $1.5 billion to the state. That's not a bad option. And I think we hope is looked upon not as dividing up. A few cents more than that, perhaps at the wellhead, as a result of different routes. We'd like to have it all. We think we can have it all if we are able to move sufficiently quickly and utilize the tools that we have gathered in the world class expertise we've gathered to take advantage of the LNG option now and pave the way for another pipeline, and we hope we hope this is built. We're going to do everything we can to encourage that to happen.
Mr. Shipkoff, then Mr. Venta.
We were going out of sequence. I thought we were all going to
answer. Oh, I'm sorry.
But no.
Go ahead. All right.
We'll
get you go there. Then we'll go in sequence. Ralph, who you want to be next? Go ahead, just shift up.
First of all, I'd like to point out the fact that the differential in the netback is not as wide as suggested by Representative Samuels. I'll draw his attention to Econ One's presentation, what we think the differential is. And we also believe that with further technical work, that differential will be narrowed further, possibly eliminated. With respect to the technical issues that have to do with LNG spec gas and pipeline spec gas, we'll be more than happy to have Bechtel's engineers have a detailed
meaningful discussion with the producers and engineers about how to resolve that issue. We don't think this is an unresolvable issue. It's a technical issue that has to be addressed.
Thank you. Who is next? Dr. Panizza.
I don't know who's next. I thought you were trying to repeat people.
Yeah. Right. Gotcha.
Representative Samuel started with closing two netbacks, and I won't quote the numbers. The point is that any of the analysis will show that contemporaneously, LNG netback will be lower than a highway pipeline netback, and it's only the movement away from contemporaneousness that you get this value. So let's say it's 10 years. You have to make the assessment. Is it, be mindful of what Mr. Porter said yesterday, is it truly that 10 years advantage you have? Are there leakages? And only if you feel comfortable that gap is pretty robust would you want to enter into this. And I think more importantly, we heard from Mr. Van Tile on this, you have to have this being accepted as a business proposition by producers. They have to see this gap as being permanent as well, because I don't think that any ambiguity would allow that three plus years to be maintained if there were any litigation, et cetera, or any contentious behavior in the FERC. So it has to be, I think, viewed as a business proposition as being viable by all parties before this can work. I have to throw back I don't know the answer to that. I've heard a lot of he said, she said from competing lawyers. They have different opinions on that liability.
Yeah, let's go to Ms. Dickinson first. Then we'll go to Van Tile. Then we'll go to...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I might take a crack at answering Representative Samuel's question, I think the way I phrased it is you do your base case, and you have two different numbers, and one clearly shows a more competitive project than the other, and so the question is, are there intangibles? We heard Mr. Walker say, well, it's competitive, so there must be other things that you can look at, and some of them you've heard mentioned here, and I just like to maybe put a slightly different spin on those, or different context on those. One of them is clearly if you have more options, you have a better case than fewer options, so kind of a diversion option. And if there is a pipeline which heads towards the AECO hub, yes, we probably will not have the ability to go into Asian markets, but I want to make very clear that the baseline pipeline to Chicago, in my humble opinion, is not the one that's going to be built. What you're going to see is a pipeline going to AECO and then options from there, maybe a strengthening or a smaller pipeline going down to Malin, which then goes into the West Coast, go down to, over the Maritime provinces. In other words, essentially the entire U.S. market, which are isolated from themselves. West Coast is isolated from the Gulf Coast market or the mid-continent market, yet we will have access to both through AECO. So I think the notion that a single market versus multiple markets is not quite right. I think it's different multiple markets that are available from the two different projects. Clearly, if the best use of the gas was the mid-continent market, and we had a project that had to go down to Kitimat, regas after that short voyage back into AECO, you'd be getting to the same point at AECO with a much higher cost of having gotten there. So that market would not be available. The second point, Mr. Shukov's comment is absolutely right. Further technical work on both of these projects may eliminate the difference. It may narrow it, but it may widen it. And no one's claimed that all the work's been done. I know that Mr. Walker is their handout and constantly talked about, I think, 55,000 hours have been, how many hours have been put into this project by Bechtel. But I think if you look at what the sponsors did back in 2001, you had over 1 million man-hours going into that project, producing the level of work that had been done. So different levels of work have been done on these projects, and further work will refine those numbers fully. So really what you've got now are sort of the best estimates at the time we have them. I think the fundamental judgment, the question you put out is the right question, and neither of those numbers is going to be the final number, but you, you have to start somewhere, and they certainly, all the work tends to suggest that those, they really are two different tiers, and that the LNG project simply doesn't produce the same kinds of results as a direct project.
Mr. Van Tile.
Thank you, Chairman Sinks. I just have two brief comments. One, regarding the GTP issue, it's ultimately resolvable. It just costs additional money to process gas to the lower spec, one that's well understood in the industry on what you have to do. It just costs more. In addition, I think it would be appropriate then to reflect that in a true characterization of the project, of the LNG project. And the other, there was a comment made that about not betting everything on one project, and I guess I would, made by Mr. Walker, and I would actually agree with that sentiment. One of the advantages we see with our project is that you have a the lowest cost project to open the basin. It makes everything else possible. And one of the things that's included in our contract is a commitment to fund 4 offtake points to provide for taking gas off in state. And also cooperation with those entities that interconnect with that project, which could include, I know NSTAR is looking at taking gas from the Fairbanks area down the rail belt into South Central. We know the Port Authority would like to take gas off in the Delta area and feed a LNG project in Valdez. Those are great options. We would like to see those things happen. We would like to compete to supply gas to those sorts of projects. So. Our project isn't a one project only that excludes other options. It actually makes these other things possible, and the contract actually provides for those other projects as well.
Sure. Representative Stoltz,
just on that point, are these issues in that the industry the industry partners are willing to come to the table again and throw these on as
flip that switch up to the top. There you go.
Part of the governor's contract that he's been pushing with the industry partners, there's been a real hesitancy to. I've talked to a lot of the, but everybody that works in the industry, and I listen to your ads. They tinker with it, fix it, don't throw it away. I say, oh, what are the things that can be triaged out, and we got to ask the governor. And it's been about as frustrating an experience as possible. And I'm hearing some openings here. I think there's a lot of good parts of the Port Authority process, and it's and I think their ultimate success might be how it's incorporated. But am I hearing some openings from industry that not to be so intransigent? That's what I, you know, it's we hear one guy used to be in the governor's office, my way is the highway, another one, it's this is an inviolate plan. I'm just you probably aren't authorized to speak about conditions, but I'm hearing an inkling of opportunity for some melding of some of the good points have been brought up.
Representative Stoltz, what I was referring to is language that's actually included in the contract today. It says, on the one hand, as everyone's aware, there's provisions in the contract for 4 offtake points in Alaska, and that's recognizing the need to bring gas into Alaska and the desire for other projects to perhaps spin off of this one. One of those clearly is the Port Authority project. In addition, there's language in the contract that commits the mainline entity to cooperate with those projects in the planning and design of their interconnections. So I think that framework's in place in the current agreement that we have before us, and the opportunity to further advance this is the participation in the open season process. That's when the parties step up and say, you know, yes, I want to take gas off at a particular point, whatnot. So I think the framework's in place with the arrangement that's been proposed.
Go ahead, Mr. Dickinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Stoltz, one of the points, additionally, going back to 50,000 feet, that this contract has is the state is going to have a slug of oil as high as 20%. For the years, it'll tail off, and it'll still be in the 17-18% range. And the point is what the state chooses to do with that is going to be a very important, is going to feed a lot of those decisions. It's not part of this fiscal contract. This is setting up the terms, you know, it's a set of base commercial arrangements, and a set of fiscal arrangements. But what the state does with that piece isn't part of this contract. It probably can't get figured out and negotiated in the next 100 days. So I guess I would emphasize the same points that Mr. Van Kahl made, but add in the fact that what the state does with its gas is going to be, I think, critical. And it's going to involve a huge debate, because one of the issues, the same issues were being debated here, which is, do we view it purely with a commercial hat on? What can we sell it for in a 5-year or 10-year or 15-year contract? You would ask, what do we do here in the state that may involve longer-term industrial development or intangible things like that? So it's not an easy or obvious set of things that we do, but at least it really will be the state within itself trying to make those policy decisions. And we certainly have options available because of the amount of gas that will be directly ours to do with as we see fit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we're all trying to figure out what this referendum was on August 22nd, we'll figure out how that fits into the plan.
Representative Kelly, anything?
No, Mr. Chairman, just I'm kind of an options guy. I like lots of options, and it's good to have this one brought before us and fleshed out over a series of days and hearings that makes a lot of the points more clear. And I think some of the, I spoke yesterday, we have 100 days, and our choice of whether to hit the reset button on the whole gas line issue, or whether someone suggests that we should move ahead to try to bring this to completion, or some combination of both. I suspect 100 days is short, and I don't see a lot of willingness among the legislators, after having been there for 6 months, to go right back down there for another 3 and hit the ball here. But those are hilltop issues that I think are important, but having this option before us and getting a chance to ask the hard questions, and I think it's important to recognize the difference between a hostile question. I know I tend to ask fairly straight-ahead, direct questions, and they're not meant to be hostile at all. They're meant to flesh this thing out. And there are some hills to climb. The Jones Act, I happen to have been watching this scene for over 50 years. If you think that's a two-bit trick, I'll tell you it isn't. And if so some of these things that the hard questions are asked for are certainly discouraging to the Port Authority, because they've been in the trenches trying to fix them, trying to make it work, trying to solve the Jones Act problem or the reflagging or whatever. But I also believe that the question of whether they can do it 3 years sooner or not is a real serious issue, because that present value is the thing which would help to convince people that they then, for the next 30 years after that, ought to go ahead and use the method of getting the gas to market, which is the 10 miles per gallon vehicle versus the 20 miles per gallon mileage vehicle, the more efficient way. They've got to overcome that, because to compress this down to 1/600th of its size, stick it in a boat, ship it, bring it through a regas plant, and then put it back in a pipeline and bring it to market, has got some difficulties which you're willing to face if you don't have another alternative, just like you're willing to face a pack mule if you don't have a railroad. So those are some of the things I'm going to be asking hard questions on, not because I have a difficulty with the project being on the table, because I am an options guy, but I think when we ask those hard questions, don't take it as hitting below the belt, because that's not what's going on here. We're trying to figure out the best thing for Alaskans. If that project can be brought on significantly early, and the present value of taking that action will offset the inefficiencies of one system over another, or if you can demonstrate where we should use that 10 miles per gallon vehicle because it has these other benefits, and some of those have been talked about here, then those are issues too that come out. So thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity for the lowly house guys to come over here and participate.
The dark side.
Because it has been helpful.
Senator Wagner.
Other than one question, I'm going to pass, and maybe it's just a request administration. In the past, for instance, Tony Palmer, I believe, was the person that made the statement. He said, for every penny difference in the tariff on this pipeline project, it'll cost cost the state over the life of the project $150 million. And I realize we don't have any real hard numbers right now, but when you look at $3.55 versus $2.17, I calculate out someplace in the tune of $20 billion or some ungodly figure like that. So I'd like to have you guys do a little bit of calculation, get a number back to me at a later date on that. And admittedly, it may change, and the numbers may change, and we don't need to get into that argument. With that, I'll pass, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Terrell.
As Representative Stoltz indicated, we're all trying to figure out what the Tuesday election was and what we should discern from that as far as going forward on this. One of the things that I've heard from my constituents is that sort of a level of unease with the proposal, any proposal going through Canada, and the uncertainty that involves. And I think that's one of the reasons why then the Port Authority and, you know, the all-Alaska concept is attractive to them. And I think, you know, if you went out and polled all those people that perhaps cast their vote because of the pipeline debate, that is weighing heavy on their minds. I'm wondering if somebody for the administration can give us an idea how we're going to deal with the uncertainty in going through Canada. We're talking about the potential for delivery, that there being a delta of 3 years. But we don't know that you're going to be able to get through Canada in 3 years. And I've heard from a member of the administration negotiating team that the contract that you've got and agreements, proposed agreements with Alaska subsidiaries of the big three companies, but that doesn't really get you anything with regard to Exxon Canada, Imperial. Do you need separate agreements with those Canadian subsidiaries of the major producers? So I think that sort of uncertainty that's in the contract right now, you know, are you going to get to a point that you actually propose to move forward on a project? And then what about all the uncertainty dealing with the federal government in Canada, separate subsidiaries in Canada? That's part of what I'm hearing from my constituency.
Commissioner Vege.
Senator Seekin.
Senator Seekin, thank you. Senator Terrio, there's no guarantees in anything in life, and certainly there's no guarantees in Canada. You look at baseline motivation, you look to the willingness of the various participants to find a solution. Certainly, you take out how it is currently running under a capacity, but that transposes itself to the maximum price paid by every Canadian producer, from the smallest to the largest. The more gas in the ecosystem, the cheaper it is to produce gas for all the Canadian producers. So there's a net max benefit to them right there. You go to the less transit things, such as Canada's our largest trading partner, and having a jihad over a transit line through Canada to market more for you to need the gas, that's would be a very difficult situation, I think, for Canadian public or their politicians to sustain. There is also the fact that this is a transit line. It's not the production line that we're looking at the Mackenzie. So it's in Canada's best interest to make this happen. It's in our best interest, and we'll have to collectively work our way through it. The Canadian National Energy Board will play the same role as FERC. They're already talking and have their agreements in place. So there's a willingness to make this market happen. And remember, this pipeline sets the stage for northern gas, not just Alaska gas, but for Arctic gas, creating a market niche in the Midwestern economy for Arctic gas, because everything in the world that helped the Canadians in their production scenario. So if you stack up all of the mutual benefits here, I think you find a very predominant amount of benefit, mutual benefit. There, of course, there'll be challenges that we face along the way. They're certainly not insurmountable, so simply have to look at what's in everyone's best interest and assume that people will work to advance a project that's in their interest, and that's the basis for which we proceed forward.
Could you speak specifically to the Canadian subsidiaries of the three major producers? Is that
something that you believe will ultimately be necessary? Because then that leads to the question of why have we struck a deal in this proposed contract with subsidiaries and not the parent companies?
I think that's speak for the NEB, and they certainly identify the framework and the resolution process for doing that, and that's probably as far as I want to go with that. However, if you create an environment in which you have to negotiate an agreement with 50 people versus 5, it's just going to complicate it more. I believe it's in the NEB's best interest because of the Canadian producer component, the Canadian consumer component, and the relationships with the U.S. to find a very efficient process through there in the preliminary talks with them as well. And again, they will react to what the best interest of Canada. I'm absolutely certain that will manifest itself into the most efficient system possible. And once the day arrives and we begin the process, then I think you'll see that happen. But it's an assumption that people will act in their own best interest, foundation upon which my comments are based.
Thank you.
Mr. Seekins, I know you're...
Go ahead.
You are well known for keeping your word on closing out hearings. I would like to take just a moment to editorialize, if you will allow me.
Go ahead.
We have spent 3 years working on this thing day and night. I would like everyone to believe that we would love to have been able to fully embrace the Port Authority project. It has given me no pleasure whatsoever to sit through long hours of debate and long hours of writing letters in response to comments made and dealing with the public that felt like the Port Authority was the best. It would have made my life a lot simpler, and I can guarantee it would have made everyone's life in the administration a lot simpler. But we can only do what we believe is in the principal best interest of Alaska. We have looked at that project 7 ways to Sunday. We have had an equal number of experts look at it, and it just simply, we do not believe, in our opinion, that it measures out. That is the basis for proceeding with the projects that we have proposed. It avoids litigation. It protects the maximum wellhead value. That's the premise. I take no pleasure in having debates about one project versus another. I've always believed that the best project will win out in the end. The one that has the best foundational economics will win out in the end. And I believe that will happen again here. But it's very, very important that you start a project like this based on economics. You have to have the gas, you have to build the infrastructure, you have to have the market. All of those things we've picked off sequentially into the midst of our ability to deal with it. We have looked at the Port Authority, and I'll just close by saying if there was any way in this green earth we could have embraced it, believe me, I would have been leading the charge. But we simply did not believe the economics was there. So thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to speak and for this forum, and I look forward to continuing to work on this project as long as there's an opportunity.
Thank you. Frankly, this is a very complex issue for many of us in the legislature. Because we're so involved in our own discussions, sometimes we don't get involved in the discussions on other issues like this. Maybe in the off session time is sometimes the best time to take a look at some of these things, because we can concentrate. There are no other committee meetings going on today, and so the stress for our time or the tension for our time is less. I absolutely agree with the premise. Underlying premise of the Port Authority. From its roots, it was to either build or cause to be built a natural gas pipeline. Am I correct there?
That's correct.
I mean, no Alaskan disagrees with that premise, in my opinion. None. Because we understand the economics, the necessity to be able to get that gas to market for the economy of the state of Alaska. Every morning when I walk into my office in Juneau or in my office in Fairbanks, On the shelf is a picture of my grandchildren, you know, and that reminds me of what the final effort that we have should be, and that is for the benefit, the future benefit, and the present benefit for the people of the state of Alaska. And I do believe
that the Port Authority is putting forward their project because they believe it is to the best benefit of the people of the state of Alaska. And I believe that there are people who oppose the project because they believe it's to the best interest of the people of the state of Alaska. And it is hard. Mr. Samuels is correct. As a business person, you know, I want to take a look and see what does it cost me to get this much gas in that big a pipe to market every day. And whichever one gives me the best wellhead value is the one that's my most favorite right from the get-go. Now, the question that seems to arise here today to me is, what is the value of being able to get market to gas sooner, and how does that come into play? It appears to me that none of this, the whole thing falls apart if all parties don't cooperate. It all falls apart. There is no economics to it if all parties don't cooperate. And so that to me seems to be vital. And it seems to me that the discussion is, well, do you want to tag off of my pipe or should I tag off of your pipe? And I don't see any resistance on the part of the producers maybe to say, well, we'll get that gas for you to Valdez and then you can have your project from there if that's what, and we'll sell you the gas to do that if that's what you want to do, but it has to come in our pipe from there to here, kind of the way I see it. Am I correct on that, Dave?
Our project would get the gas to Delta.
To Delta,
the optic
right,
would be.
To Delta, to the right. Optic, yes. And, I mean, and so it isn't there's, I think that the discussion here seems to be, to me, to be that. Is it going to be from my pipe to Delta or your pipe to Delta? And you can go from here on down to Chicago or you can go from here on down to Valdez. And it's kind of the question. Getting the gas, having a defined market, getting together with some kind of a commercial agreement, all those things seem to be contingent upon the project that is most beneficial to the people of the state of Alaska. I know more about this now than I ever thought I would know, and I do appreciate the fact that we have had the opportunity to discuss it in this roundtable type of a discussion. I think it benefits myself, it benefits other members, it benefits the state of Alaska to have this kind of an open discussion. I think there's some huge hurdles out there, Mr. Whitaker, and I hope and pray that you can overcome some of those and provide some value to the people of the state of Alaska from getting that gas to market. As I said, I think everyone in this room probably agrees with the premise of the Port Authority. How do we get there? And what makes it economic? Do we all agree on the fact that the real economic benefit comes from being able to get it there quicker? That's the key. I mean, is anybody disagree with that premise? Mr. Dickinson, you may not.
Chairman Stevens, clearly that's one aspect of it, but he wouldn't want to build something that you could do 2 years sooner and then you pay the price of the subsequent
right.
30 years.
Unless it pays off greater on the up end to compensate for the lower end. But I understand.
I guess the only thing I would add to that, Chairman, Ken Griffin. The only thing I would add to that, Chairman, is that looking at the numbers that Dr. Fenica prepared, I think it was on page 46, the 2013 start date has about a 5% improvement in net present value over the highway route. If that 2013 start date slips to 2016, 3 years, you've lost 20% of that net present value. You know, with compounding, that's about 6% a year being lost. So if you start in 2014 instead of 2013, lose 1 year, you've already lost the additional value that you hope to gain by this additional capital investment to achieve this. I think it's important to think that while we're looking at 3 years, we're looking at a project concept that has such fragility that provides just 1 year, the economic benefits are eliminated.
Mayor Whitaker.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know that time is late, and I'll take this.
We're going to accommodate you.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Assuming that there are no other statements that we are compelled to respond to, well, this will be the close.
Correct. Go right ahead.
There are a number of issues that have been discussed, and again, we're thankful for the opportunity to have had to participate during the course of these discussions. A great deal of discussion has taken place with regard to markets. We've talked about the lower 48 markets. We've talked about the potential for gas going to foreign markets, specifically Japan. One of the markets that we haven't talked a lot about is the Alaska market, and that's first and foremost in the mission of the Port Authority. Reasonably priced energy to Alaska is a significant part of our mission. We will ensure that that mission is fulfilled. Gas will be supplied to South Central. Gas will be available in Fairbanks. And if we are able to build the model appropriately, gas that is purchased in Fairbanks will not be relative in value to the weather in Florida in the hurricane season. As it is, if the gas is valued relative to a hub in the Midwest. So those things are important to us. We think they're important to Alaskans, and we think that they're also important to the legislature, given that you do represent Alaskans. One of the issues that has not been discussed at great length is the motivation of the participants. The participants from the producer side, British Petroleum, Exxon, ConocoPhillips, is clear. Their mandate is to enrich their stockholders. I wish that I wasn't conflicted. I would have purchased stock in probably all three of those companies. They're good companies. They're well run. And they're doing well. That's their motivation. We understand. Port Authority's motivation is different. Our motivation is to do what is in the best interest of the state of Alaska, the citizens of Alaska. I've mentioned reasonably priced energy, but also our motivation is to ensure that a project gets built. We are absolutely motivated to build this project. You mentioned that is our mandate. When the voters of this community voted in 1999 to approve this entity, it was very clear, build or cost to be built. And we're doing everything we can to prod everybody that we can to either build it or do everything that we can to build it ourselves. We understand that. That is our mandate. We do not have other options, and that's why that is our mandate. And so as we presented this slide on the first day of this discussion, we showed the map of the world, and we show the market dynamic that is in play. We do not have another LNG project that we can bring gas to market from. We do not have other market sources, other production sources that we can bring to bear on the marketplace. Alaska is it for us and for Alaska. And so as we compare the motivation of the participants, it's clear that we don't need a four-year study to know that we damn well want to build this project and take Alaska gas. We don't want to look at other foreign options. We want this project built. And that's the greatest risk for Alaska, that the project will not get built, that the market will come into equilibrium. And if that happens, and Alaska's gas is not part of that equilibrium, then you will need a continuation of the Stranded Gas Development Act, because this gas will be stranded. Our motivation is to take gas to market and have Alaskans benefit. And that's our closing statement. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We're running on the time because some of you guys got to meet a 12:30 airplane. If there's anything that's vital to be added, we'll be glad to take a minute. Any closing minutes? Roger, did you have one?
Well,
and I do really appreciate the Port Authority, by the way, Mr. Mayor. I do appreciate the fact that you people were so forthcoming with the information and cooperative with our consultant from the legislature. He did tell us that Mr. Shipkoff spent a tremendous amount of time and was very helpful, very open, and we do appreciate
that high level of cooperation.
It was a pleasure for me to work with.
Roger.
Well, you know, if indeed these projects are in conflict, you know, it's possible that competing forces could cause none of them to be built. You know, I hope 20 years from me, nobody wants this project built more than I do, and probably everyone in the room feels the same way. You know, I hope 20 years from now, if there is no project, people look back at the summer of 2006 and say, boy, that was the closest we ever got.
Yeah, I agree with that. We may, some of the members of the committee have indicated that there may be some additional questions that we may want to address as we go forward. We want to thank Dr. Finizza for being here and providing us with this work on such short notice and working with the people from the Port Authority. I think all the members of Dave, thank you for being here to represent the producers. Thank all the administrative members from the administration. We do appreciate the fact that you gentlemen were here. I think this has been very fruitful for me and for other members, and thank you very much, and hopefully it's been informative to the people of the state of Alaska as well. I think it has allowed a fresh look at the Port Authority outside of the headlines and the pages of the newspaper. So thank you for all cooperating. And are there any questions from Senator Elton?
No, but thanks to everybody that participated up there, Mr. Chair.
Is Representative Seaton still online? Anyone else? Thank you for being with us, Kim, and with that, we are adjourned.